Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On Earth Day in 2003, today's guest, journalist Dar Jamel, was hanging by a rope in a crevasse inside a glacier in Alaska, having narrowly avoided falling to his death. In the introduction to his new book, The End of Ice, he recalls marveling at the beauty of the ice around him. Today, the world's ice is melting faster than ever. In his new book, Dar Jamel documents his travels around the world and the conversations he has with people who study, measure, and experience the devastating impacts of climate disruption. He writes, quote, "For decades, many of us have turned a blind eye to what is happening to the planet. But now, given that Earth may well be dying, we may be ready to stand up to protect what we love." So with the Earth so far gone, how do we grieve while maintaining focused on saving what we love? Dar Jamel is a former war reporter. We've had him on the show many times talking about his reporting on the U.S. invasion of Iraq. He started writing about the environment and the climate in 2010 and has since published more than 100 articles about climate change, the climate crisis, and climate disruption. His new book is The End of Ice, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption. Hi, Dar. Welcome back to the show. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Rose. It's great to be back.
Well, congratulations on the book, Dar. And I actually want to start off with the conclusion, because I felt like when I read the conclusion, that's when I really stopped and everything you wrote really sunk in. And you write that reporting on the catastrophic impact of climate disruption for this book involved trips to the front lines of collapsing geo and biospheres and interviews and reports about near apocalyptic scenarios. Though I learned to find a way of looking unwaveringly at what was happening to the planet, I fell into a deep depression and I began to wonder whether there was any point in even writing about this. Can you talk more about that? Because honestly, that's how we feel doing this show. I mean, every Monday we focus on these issues and it takes a toll after a while. I mean, you saw it firsthand, so I'm sure the toll was even more intense.
It does take a toll. And I think anybody paying really close attention, even just listeners and readers out there really staying tuned in to what's happening to the planet, it's devastating, and it should be. And how can it not? I mean, if we're really paying attention and really feeling inside of ourselves what this means, because, you know, it's not a stretch at all to understand that what happens to the planet, that's what's happening to us. We aren't going to exist without these systems functioning and healthy, and we're watching them, some of them collapsing completely and others vanishing altogether. So it is extremely hard, and I struggled with that for years. And when I really, after a few years of a lot of really serious articles about how far along we already are with climate disruption, I struggled back then. I'm talking 2003, with depression and hopelessness and what to do with all of these feelings and the rage and the guilt of, you know, I fly, I drive cars, all of this, you know, I'm a contributor. And I had to try to start figuring out what to do with that. And the blessing of the book was one of my key solutions, even before I began writing it, was just to consistently have time out in nature and go spend time in these places that are really, really important to me. And for me, my favorite is the mountains. And so I would go out there and reconnect. And I think that's kind of how I've learned to balance all of this information with you know, going out in there and remembering this is why I'm doing the work, and staying connected into these places and listening and remembering that, well, this is what we're fighting for.
And Dar, how has your thinking about this really changed over the years? I heard you on another radio show say that you used to embrace the idea that we're kind of doomed, but you have since really changed your thinking. Can you talk more about that?
I have. Really, what's changed the most is kind of my response to the information. I still, when you look at all the data and you look at the runaway feedback loops that are kicked in and you look at these increasingly dire studies that are published, It really does look bad. I mean, even the possibility of human extinction is, you know, becoming being discussed increasingly frequently, even in scientific communities. And so we are in big trouble, and we're in for catastrophic change. There's no way around that. So that, on top of the fact that it is commonly known now that we are in the sixth mass extinction and we are the root cause of it. So that all remains on the table, and that really hasn't changed in my understanding of this is basically where we are. But what has changed is that it's really what's more important than the results of what I do or what anyone else does to try to stop this, or, well, at this point, mitigate it. We're not going to stop it, is taking the right action regardless of whatever those results might end up being. Besides, we don't have any control over them anyhow. What I can control right now is my personal response, and it's that these systems are still here. There are still glaciers, there's functioning forests, there's still wild, amazing areas on the planet, and I feel morally obliged to do what I can to connect to them and to help protect them and take care of them while they're still here. And one thing I bring up in the book is that, you know, Western colonial mindset and the culture that goes along with that is this idea of that we all have these rights. And that really flies in the face of indigenous understandings and traditions that we have moral obligations. We are morally obliged to future generations and to work to take care of the earth. And that really has been a big shift in me of regardless of what the outcomes, regardless of how doomed it might appear as we are, the only way for me to really exist psychologically and spiritually today is to just really live in kind of more of a service place of what can I do each day to try to take care of the planet.
I really also appreciate, Dar, in your conclusion, you write about various Native Americans that you've interviewed, spoken with, people have shared stories with you. You talk about the genocide in California and really connect all the dots. I so appreciate that. Can you tell us just quickly about Stan Rushworth? He's an elder of Cherokee descent who has taught Native American literature and critical thinking classes focused on indigenous perspectives. He's been doing this for more than a quarter of a century. Tell us about the conversation you had with him.
I met Stan last June, and it literally changed the entire ending of my book. I was right up against deadline for final edits, and I met him, and we had conversations, and I realized I have to completely rewrite the last 10 pages of the book. And so needless to say, he had a profound effect on me and my perspective and my thinking and how I was approaching this whole thing. And he shared several really powerful stories with me. And, you know, one of them being that, you know, his father, who was a professor at one of the university, I believe it was UC Davis, understood back in, I believe it was the 80s, that, look, we're off the cliff. We've kind of screwed ourselves at this point with what we've already done to the planet. And he said, you know, but one never knows. And that kind of introduced this new line into my own thinking that, you know, that doesn't mean that things aren't absolutely bleak, and it certainly looks like we're heading in a very, very bad direction, but it leaves room for the possibility just simply that, you know, we don't have the final say. You know, nature and the planet are far bigger, more complex and powerful than we are. Humans are not in control of this thing, and that's just to say that we don't know where all of this is going to go for sure, that there might still be a way for human species to continue beyond what it looks like where we're headed right now, which is it may well not, and just kind of leaving open that possibility that, you know, there are other forces at work and it's not just us.
And before we dive in, Dar, and talk about the places you visited and experienced, I just wanted to talk with you quickly about the record-breaking cold in the Midwest. I was reading about this last night, and growing up in California, I can't even fathom what it's like to be in 21 below zero weather. That's what it was in Chicago yesterday, with a wind chill of 51 below, and it looks like the death toll is now up to 10. Schools are shut down. The Postal Service is not delivering mail. I believe it was in Chicago, train tracks had to be basically burned. They were on fire to keep them warm. I mean, this is a crisis for homeless people. It's just amazing to see. I mean, so much is happening right now.
It is, and this is a perfect example of climate disruption, and that's why I tend to prefer that term instead of climate change. And, you know, we had this huge swath of warm air manage its way up into the Arctic from Morocco a little ways back. This completely disrupted the jet stream and the systems that are you know, have historically functioned in a certain way, that which is why the jet stream has been more stable and kept all of this frigid air up in the Arctic where it belongs, and that gets disrupted. And now, once again, this polar vortex, a term that most people in the U.S. are unfortunately now all too aware of, is happening. And this is a perfect example. Meanwhile, you have temperatures in parts of the Midwest that where it's colder there than it is in Antarctica. What's wrong with this picture? You have temperatures there that are far colder than it is even up over the Arctic Ocean right now, north of Alaska. Again, what's wrong with this picture? And when you throw things this far out of balance, you are inevitably going to have catastrophic results. And this is, you know, this makes it easier for people to understand, too, why the Arctic is warming. Yet another reason why the Arctic is warming as fast as it is, and what the ramifications of that for the rest of the planet.
In February 2017, you went to Australia during an unprecedented heat wave with record temperatures. In some areas, it was over 116. And that's what we saw in Australia last week.
That's right. And when I was there, I was there to go out and do research on the Great Barrier Reef. And I just happened to be there within the first week of when that year's coral bleaching event occurred. And coral bleaching, in a nutshell, is what happens when waters become too warm for coral. They eject the algae that gives them their color and their nutrients, because that algae becomes toxic. And then when that happens, they become bone white, hence the term coral bleaching. And if that water doesn't cool down in time, the coral dies. That year alone, 30% of the coral that bleached died. The next year, another bleaching event struck the reef, and 20% of it died. So we're literally watching what scientists have referred to as the terminal stage of the Great Barrier Reef, the single biggest coral ecosystem on the planet at 1,400 miles long. And that is a harbinger of things that are happening to coral around most of the world. And we've even had a NOAA report from back in 2011, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration report, that warned that at current trajectories, without dramatic mitigation and changes, we are at risk of losing most of the coral reefs on the planet before 2050. And right now, it appears as though we are ahead of that pace.
And as you write in your chapter, Farewell Coral, coral reef ecosystems cover less than 2% of Earth's ocean floor, yet are home to one quarter of all marine species. Some reports show that coral reefs even surpass rainforests in terms of biodiversity. Without coral, the entire oceanic ecosystem takes a turn for the worse. Before we talk about the conversation you had with John Rumney, an American who moved to Australia 3 decades ago and told you he basically lives on the reef, which I loved, Dar, talk about what it's like to snorkel in the Great Barrier Reef, especially when you're in the parts of the reef that are still so alive and full of fish and beautiful coral.
Well, it's an amazing experience that I wish every human on the planet could experience, because if everyone did, then everyone would understand why these places are so magical and why it's so important to take care of them. I mean, it really is a feast of sensory perception. I mean, it was really overstimulation of all senses. And that, you know, you snorkel, you're in this crystal clear water. It's really not very cold, and there's fish, abundant fish life everywhere, beautiful tropical fish of literally every color imaginable, sounds. It's an extremely busy place. You have the clicking of shrimp. You have parrotfish gnawing on coral, clicks and grinding and all kinds of sounds, and fish and sharks swimming by. So it's really an amazing, amazing experience. In certain parts of the reef, where they're extremely healthy, you literally have, I described it as life growing upon life, where you have literally different types of coral growing out of literally other types of coral, fish swimming all in between them, giant sea anemones with clownfish swimming in them. So it really is an amazing, powerful experience to get to snorkel in an area like that.
What did you hear from John Rumney? I love all these amazing people that you interviewed who basically dedicate their lives to saving the reefs and really saving the planet. This is an American who moved to Australia 3 decades ago, and he's been diving the reef for more than 40 years. He's the founder of the organization called the Great Barrier Reef Legacy Group.
Right, and so that group, he loves the reef, and that's the core thing about him and all of the scientists and people I got to spend time with out in the field working on this book. I mean, you talk with him, and as John talks about the reef, his eyes sparkle. I mean, he might as well be just talking about his lover, and it's a really, it's contagious. You know, you get excited, and we were having dinner at a harbor the night before we went out on the reef, and he starts talking about it, and his eyes light up, and he's telling all of these stories. But it's just like the experience then of going out and seeing the reef and then seeing the healthy parts compared to the parts that are dying or already dead. It's bittersweet, and that's the experience of talking with him, because he'll be 1 minute extremely excited and talking about gains they'd made over the years and getting more of the reef protected by the government of Australia and gains they're making in his group, Great Barrier Reef Legacy, which its sole aim is to try to get funding and get more scientists and people out on the reef than ever before, because people need to see what's happening in hopes of doing something about it. And he would then become dismayed the next moment talking about what's been lost and the dramatic changes he's seen in the decades that he's been there, that he's literally seen. You know, he would describe a sizable percentage of loss of the amount of sea life on the reef. I think probably he would say even well over half in areas where coral, even out on the outer edge of the reef, where there's a drop off of roughly 6,000 feet, where it's cooler water, and you would expect that to be a better area as far as not having as much coral bleaching. But even out in these areas, they're starting to see bleaching. And he described kind of the degradation of the reef over time, where we're on shore, and he pointed out at a harbor and said, look, there used to be functional coral reefs right here, right on the edge of this harbor, and now we have to get in a boat and go out probably 30 to 45 minutes before we start getting into any coral that's in decent shape.
So for a guy like John Rumney, who basically lives on the reef, what kind of changes does he want to see?
Well, he is living his life based on trying to get more protection from the reef from the government of Australia, because there's multiple assaults happening. It's obviously the warming ocean water is the really primary reason the reef is undergoing such negative changes. But there's also things like the Australian government wanting to build more ports and be shipping coal over the reef, oil terminals, gas terminals, things like this, increasing tourism that's not being done in a way that's being mindful and protective of the reef, and other increasing boat traffic, pollution runoff from and fertilizer runoff from farms and industry onshore. So there's a kind of a multi-pronged attack happening against the reef right now. And so he's trying to change all that. He's trying to increase awareness. He's trying to bring all of these issues in much sharper focus and attention to the Australian government. And then, of course, let alone, they're always talking about climate change and the need to all of us to start reducing fossil fuel emissions yesterday.
Today we're speaking with reporter Dar Jamal about his new book, The End of Ice, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions for Dar about his travels, all of the amazing things that he saw, and really just facing the reality of what's to come and what we're currently experiencing, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Dar has several upcoming speaking engagements. Tonight, he'll be at the First Congregational Church of Berkeley, 2345 Channing Way, February 2nd. That's tonight at 7:30. Saturday, February 2nd, also at 7:30, First Presbyterian Church in San Anselmo in California, 72 Kensington Road. And if you're near the Santa Fe, New Mexico area, he'll be there March 13th at 7 p.m. at the Lensic Performing Arts Center, 211 West San Francisco Street. And let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Carol in Oakland. Hi, Carol. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning, and thank you for the show and the book. And I just wanted to share one thing I've done is I won't get in my car unless I have at least three things to do. So I really try to be conscientious about using my car. And I teach health at community college. And I used to teach about the environment, but now, instead of doing that, I actually assign my students to do group projects about the environment. So I found that when I was teaching, it just seemed like they didn't get it, but by having them do projects, at least that, you know, one group is focusing on coral reefs and others focusing on fires and different things. And I'm actually learning more from them, which has been great. But I also had a question about people having children. I mean, I love children. And every time I hear somebody, you know, that somebody's pregnant, I think, oh my gosh, you know, are you paying attention? And it's hard for me to get excited. And I just wonder, you know, with Dar, like, how do you respond? I mean, what hope can you have for, you know, children coming into this world?
Well, that's a very good and important question. And I've watched myself vacillate from feeling exactly the way you just expressed to other feelings about it, too, strong feelings and a lot of judgment that I have to admit. And, you know, I today I'm in a place where, kind of hearkening back to one of the first things Rose and I discussed at the beginning of kind of this X factor of, we don't know precisely how much longer we have before this gets to a point where literally civilization as we know it is untenable. Is it next month? Is it next year? Is it 5 years? Is it 10 years? You know, and before things really become, I think, so pervasively bad that literally life starts to become challenging for almost everyone on the planet, not just certain areas as we're seeing right now. And the reality is, though, with the decision to have or to not have a child is, I think, more than ever, it has to be ideally an extremely conscious decision. And people that are going to make the decision to do so, I think, have to be prepared to raise a child in a different world, and then at some point during that child's development, know how to have a conversation with them about this is the world that we've brought you into, and now we're going to do the best we can to prepare you for living in this world. And, you know, obviously, I would still probably have I definitely still have judgment about someone having a whole lot of kids at this point. And I think that should be factored into the equation, because it is going to be extremely difficult. And, you know, even here in the West, where, you know, we, not all of us, I mean, we already have plenty of climate refugees in the United States, and that number is only going to keep increasing. But we still have large parts of the infrastructure functioning, and we're still kind of going about business as usual. But that's all going to change. And so I think people need to be very, very conscious of that fact if they're going to consider having children, and certainly how many children.
And it's also important to raise the fact that the U.S., with less than 5% of the global population, uses about a quarter of the world's fossil fuel resources. And that's a really important point to make when we talk about the population. And Dar, since Carol brought this up, I'm wondering what you think, because this is a topic that progressives have really struggled with for so long, talking about population control, the population explosion, what have you. Where do you see that population conversation fitting into the larger conversation around climate change?
Well, I think it's intellectually dishonest to not talk about overpopulation when we talk about climate change. You know, there's simply too many people on the planet. We're at, what, 6.6 billion and counting. Future projections show us it hitting 9 before 2050. This is untenable. I mean, we know for a fact crop failure is coming. There's numerous scientific studies out. I've written about a lot of them about soil now losing nutrients, food having less nutrients. Crop yields are slated to decrease looking into the future while population keeps increasing. So you can look at those two trends and understand this is not going to end well. And so overpopulation is a very, very real problem. The only reason we can feed the number of people on the planet today is because of these intensely long supply chains around the planet and the massive amount of fossil fuels required for industrial agriculture. And we have to know that looking at what's happening, shifting rainfall patterns, shifting seasons, increasing droughts, this is not sustainable. And so ideally, we would be in kind of a voluntary depopulation mode of people having less or no kids and try to bring that global population down. But unfortunately, we don't see overall that trend happening. But I think overpopulation, excuse me, is a very, very real part of this conversation, and we have to talk about it.
Well, thank you, Carol. We will jot this down and do a show about it in the near future. Today, we're speaking with reporter Dar Jamel about his new book, The End of Ice, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will discuss reports of negotiations between U.S. diplomats and members of the Taliban that could lead to U.S. troops withdrawing from Afghanistan. We'll talk about media coverage of that. We'll also talk about the more than 1,000 journalists and staff from a number of outlets, including BuzzFeed and Huffington Post. They were laid off. What does this mean for the media? That is tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're joined by reporter Dar Jamel. He's out with a very important new book, The End of Ice, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption. He's got a number of events coming up. Tonight at 7:30, he'll be at the First Congregational Church of Berkeley. February 2nd at 7:30, First Presbyterian Church in San Anselmo. Those are both in Northern California. And then March 13th, he'll be at the Lenzic Performing Arts Center in Santa Fe, New Mexico at 7 p.m. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. So we talked about your experience snorkeling in the Great Barrier Reef and what's happening to the coral. Let's talk about your experience mountaineering. You write about a near-death incident falling from the inside of a glacier. And like snorkeling, Dar, this is something that most people will never do. I mean, seeing a glacier, but even being inside of a glacier. First off, describe what that is like.
Well, ideally, you're not spending too much time inside the glacier. I'll start with that.
Right.
So I love mountaineering. I love being up in the mountains. It's really my favorite place to be on the planet. And so I moved up to Alaska in 1996 and spent a whole lot of time doing exactly that. And so I start the book with this crevasse fall, and I'm excuse me, I'm on a glacier called the Matanuska Glacier. It's about a 2.5 hour drive outside of Anchorage in the Chugach Mountain Range, and I'm with a few friends, and we are roped up and traveling across the glacier. You have to be roped up to do that in case you do punch through a snow bridge and fall in, and that's what happened. We didn't know we were even going over a snow bridge, which is often the case when you're doing glacier travel, and I punched through and pulled my partner as I fell, it pulled him to the edge. He was unable to get in an ice axe and get any purchase to stop himself. And it was really just a fluke that literally right when he got to the edge of the crevasse, rather than coming all the way in, the rope had dug enough through the lip of the crevasse that instead of pulling him horizontally, I started at the last literally 6 inches pulling him straight down vertically, and that's what stopped us. So I hung there. I was unable to self-rescue since he was right on the edge and couldn't get any other protection in to secure us. And so we had to just wait for the other two folks in our group to catch up set up a Z pulley system and get us out of that predicament. And so I had time to, as you mentioned at the top of the discussion, to kind of really, really look at the ice and really meditate. And that's what I did to keep my cool and not worry, because I couldn't see the bottom of the crevasse as they are so big up in Alaska. And fortunately, was able to get out of it. But what I really chose that scene to start the book because I was rescued and I got out of it and I roared in relief and was crying with relief to still be alive because it was an extremely close call. And as I was writing the book, I realized that at that time I was acutely aware already of dramatic impacts of climate change. We were already seeing major glacial recessions and major changes across Alaska in the mid-90s. And I knew even then that in retrospect that part of that anguish was about what was already happening to the planet.
And talk just about the experience of being so close to that ice and just how it's such a beautiful turquoise blue and just what it looks like, why it's so captivating.
Yeah, because the fascinating thing about being in a crevasse and the deeper you go is the darker the blue the ice becomes because it's older and more compressed and there's less air in it. It's a lighter color when there's less compression and there's more air in it. So the deeper you go, you come across these, at first it's kind of a bluish white ice towards the top and then it turns more turquoise and then the deeper you go, you can get into some deep blue, navy blue colored ice, and it's really one of the most beautiful colors I've ever seen. And so it's a thing to be appreciated, and then also to remember the significance of glaciers. They're not just these really cool looking areas of ice around the globe that if they go away, and they are going away, then ecosystems that rely on them go away. And now there's, as we speak, about 250 million people around the world. Glaciers are their sole source of drinking water. And if we talk about irrigation in one area of Asia alone, where several of the major rivers are sourced out of the Himalaya and their primary water source is glaciers for significant parts of the year, we're talking about 1.5 billion people in that one area of the world alone that we're going to be are going to be dramatically impacted in their ability just to grow food as glaciers go away. And disconcertingly, scientists that I interviewed in the book, and there's several other studies that agree with what they said, warned that at current trajectories, we will have no alpine glaciers left anywhere on the planet by 2100.
Wow. I mean, the numbers are shocking, Dar. In addition to that statistic, in North America, you write that 70% of the glaciers in Western Canada are projected to be gone by 2100. Montana's Glacier National Park will most likely not have any active glaciers by 2030. I mean, this is just, again, happening before our eyes. You mentioned a couple of the impacts. What else? I mean, what will happen to the ecosystems as these glaciers continue to melt?
Well, this is something that I learned a lot working on the book, that I knew some of the bigger impacts, the obvious impact on humans of lack of water. But Dr. Dan Fagree, a U.S. Geological Survey scientist who is based at Glacier National Park in Montana, and I spent some time with him, and he's in my chapter on glaciers, obviously, significantly, and he really educated me into the impact on ecosystems in a glacier. So that are relying upon a glacier. So, for example, you have a glacier in a valley, and as that glacier recedes and then as it goes away, as so many are, then the one example would be that glacier keeps the stream coming out of it a certain, obviously, colder temperature than it would be if that glacier's not there. So if there's things like bull trout in Glacier National Park that rely on that water being quite chilly, and then there's certain insects that also live in that temperature zone, as that glacier goes away, those fish and those insects can't live in the stream. So other animals then that would rely on those, whether they're birds or bears or what have you, that rely on those fish and insects, those animals are going to go away. Other impacts would be if you take a glacier out of the picture, all that groundwater is going to be lost, and it's going to change what trees can grow where. So if certain then trees start going away from those ecosystems, everything that lives in those trees is going to go with them, and then everything that relies on those species is going to go away. So I gave a lot of space for this in the book because I thought it was very, very important for people to understand that, you know, by losing this one part of the system, you have these cascading effects through the entire ecology that, you know, again, more and more of these unforeseen consequences to our actions. And that's just with glaciers. And when we kind of pan out and look at the loss of coral reefs, the loss of forests, and all these other areas that I explore in the book, then you tie that all together, then I think that really paints a better picture, a clearer picture of how devastating these impacts that we've made on the planet are. And when you put it all together, you know, that's why we are going into a catastrophic situation with climate change, because then as these loops, these feedback loops persist, they start playing off each other. And that's what also Dr. Fagri told me when I asked him, well, you know, Dan, what really keeps you up at night when you're looking at climate change? And he says, it's really these nonlinear feedback loops feeding off one another. That's what really keeps me up at night.
Mm. Dar Jamal is author of The End of Ice, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption. If you have any questions for Dar, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's hear from Becky in Berkeley. Hi, Becky. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. Thanks so much for this call. I wanted to mention that there are several organizations in the country that are working on this issue, and the Sunrise Movement is a youth-led organization. They've been working on the Green New Deal, and they are sponsoring a live stream party this February 5th, Tuesday night, and other organizations are supporting that as well. So people may want to find a house party and check that out. And also, there are organizations like the 350 Bay Area that is working regionally on climate change to get off fossil fuels, change transportation, and various other issues. And all these websites have actions that you can take, that you can plug into for people who are listening to this and getting really worked up or depressed. You know, there are actions, there are things that you can do. And also the Justice Democrats is an organization that's working to elect specifically progressive candidates that are really strong on climate disruption, as Dar called it. So I just wanted to put that out there for people, and thank you for this show.
Well, thank you for calling in, Becky, and we'll add links at yourcallradio.org. Dar, we've been doing a couple of shows about the Green New Deal, and I wonder what you think about it, because I guess the thing that's really frustrated me over the years is when we have guests on, really good people, activists, scientists, academics, when I ask them, you know, what policy changes would they like to see, everybody has a different answer. And, you know, if you stop someone on the street, they'd probably say, well, we need solar and wind. But I really wanted to drill down to talk about specific changes. And we did that a couple of weeks ago. I mean, what are your thoughts about this, the talk about the Green New Deal, and what real changes need to be made?
Well, I think the Green New Deal is fantastic legislation, and let's not worry about how far it gets and if it passes or any of that, but just standing on its own, it is the type of response that this government, it would be a great starting point where it really talks about, we have a very firm timeline. I think it's getting off fossil fuels within 10 years and this major shift to renewables, et cetera, along with all of the other social justice aspects of it and economic justice aspects. I mean, it's a wonderful, wonderful model, and I absolutely support it. And the Sunrise Movement and all of these, I think, are beautiful actions and gestures for people to be taking at this time. But I think this is the the part where we have to be very, very honest about how far along we already are with climate mm-hmm. disruption. And I mean, I think most people that are up on the topic know we're not going to stop climate change. We're not going to turn it around or any of that. It's about what can we do to try to mitigate the situation so that perhaps instead of hitting worst case projections, we can shave 1 or 2 degrees C warming off of that. But the reality is, if we stopped all fossil fuel emissions on a dime globally today, there's a lot of science to back the fact that we already have at a minimum 3C global warming increase that's already baked into the system. And when I say that, an example of that that I'd use from Dr. Harold Wanless, a leading sea level rise expert at University of Miami, he said, look, the oceans have absorbed 93.7% of all the heat that we've added to the atmosphere. That is so much energy that if they hadn't done that, our atmosphere would be 97 degrees Fahrenheit hotter than it is right now. And so that we're talking about serious energy. And he looked at me when we were talking in his office and he says, you know, we've kicked the bucket, we're off the cliff, we're not going to get that heat out of the oceans. So when we look at these dramatic studies that have been published in just the last few weeks about Greenland and in the Antarctic, this dramatic uptick in melting that we're seeing is happening largely because the melting is from below because of the warming oceans. And then we talk about what's happening to the coral and marine life and ocean acidification and all of this. I mean, it's a situation that is irreversible, and you're not going to remove that heat. And when we talk about 3C increase, we talk about basically collapse of the current industrial agriculture system around the world that is allowing us to have this many people on the planet. Big parts of that are literally going to go away as droughts increase, significantly rainfall patterns change, et cetera, et cetera. We lose huge parts of the biosphere at 3C warming. It kicks in more feedback loops than of course speeds the process. And that's basically our best case scenario right now.
Can you explain what you mean by 3C?
3 degrees Celsius, right? So when we talk about future climate projections, you know, the scientific community, everyone is, it's in metrics. And so, you know, we look at the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and their future projections. You know, I think their worst case scenario of warming by 2100 is something like between 3 and 4 degrees C warming. And the reality is that's that worst case projection is really already baked in to the system because of what the changes we've already caused with how fast glaciers receding and how fast soil is drying out and the number of heat waves and wildfires that's increasing, et cetera, et cetera. And another way to think about this is, you know, we talk about these positive feedback loops. The most famous and well-known probably being that as the Arctic sea ice diminishes because the atmosphere is warmed, so the ice shrinks, and it's also being shrunk from the Arctic Ocean warming up, then that allows in more solar radiation into the blue ocean, which warms it faster, which shrinks the ice faster, and so it goes. Another way to put that more simply, as Dr. Dan Fagery at Glacier National Park said, the more something happens, the more it happens. And so we're starting to see that with beetle kills in forests as temperatures warm up, as droughts persist, the more increasing wildfires, as we know all too well here in California, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so when these things start feeding back into themselves and off of each other, that's why when we talk about these really catastrophic projections of 3 degrees C warming, and there's some, just for context, there's both a International Energy Agency analysis that warns that we could see a 5C increase by just 2050. And then last fall, The Independent published a story about how analysts from BP and Shell are predicting that we could see a 5C increase also by 2050. And so that's not that long. And when we talk about that amount of increase, everything we're seeing on the planet right now is from a 1.1C increase that we've raised the temperature since the industrial age began. So when we're talking about 2, 3, 4, or 5C, it gets pretty hard to imagine what that really means.
Well, this is hard to fathom because, correct me if I'm wrong, but 5 degrees Celsius is 41 degrees Fahrenheit?
No. Roughly, that's basically the direct temperature correlation. When we talk about 5C, we're talking about, I believe that's somewhere around between 8 and 10 degrees Fahrenheit. Just that total amount that we would raise it from where we are right
now. The total amount. Okay, thank you.
Right, sorry about that.
It's fine. This is good to think of, to really explain, because sometimes you hear these phrases and it's hard to wrap your head around these numbers. And just quickly, Dar, I want to take a few more callers, but since you brought up the oil industry, I have to say, every time we do shows about this, I think it's important to repeat the fact that we now know that Exxon, Texaco, Shell, Chevron, they knew about these dangers back in the 1970s.
That's right. And it's well documented now. There's been some fantastic journalism done on this. And I don't know how much more could possibly be exposed at this point with documents and everything that they have known. And not only that, gone to great lengths to not just obfuscate or hide the truth, but then, this kind of ongoing denial campaign, which, the current iteration of it, it started out basically they were using the same tactics as Big Tobacco did. Well, let's just, we can't pretend that cigarettes aren't causing cancer, but if we just put in a little bit of doubt, then that's going to, we need more research, et cetera, to really show how much they're really contributing. And that's exactly the same tactic that we're seeing being played out today, where, it's what's happening is so obvious and it's undeniable even to Republicans and people who are receiving the brunt of the donations from the fossil fuel industry. So they don't deny that it's happening, but their current meme is, but we don't know how much humans are really playing a role in this.
Well, luckily, the Supreme Court declined to hear ExxonMobil's appeal in a climate change lawsuit. This happened just a couple weeks ago. So they're now going to have to turn over internal documents about what they knew about climate change. So that's one something that we'll definitely look at and report on. Let's take another caller before we end the show. Let's go to Julian in Berkeley. Hi, Julian. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. So what I wanted to say is that I really appreciate this book, and I really appreciate this conversation that we're talking about the collapse of all these ecosystems and basically, the world that sustains us. Because often the narrative that we hear is that if we start doing something now, then we're going to fix this. And I think that what is missing in that piece is that we're not starting anything, we're actually going the opposite direction of causing more damage, and every time we're doing it faster and more impactful. So I think it's important to talk about just the collapse that we're facing now and where we're going, instead of just having this magical thinking that somehow we're going to fix it. So thank you for having this interview and for writing the book.
Well, thank you, Julian. And I think that's a extremely important point. And that really brings us perfectly back around full circle to how we started the conversation, which is where I end the book, is we have to start there. We have to be completely honest about how far along we are in this situation and the gravity of that and what that means, that Western civilization as we know it is not going to continue. It's impossible now in these conditions, not even to speak of the economic factors, just from climate impacts alone. And then we have to start there, and we have to take all that in and feel it and go through the range of emotions, and then come out the other side more clear-eyed and more grounded, and really, I think, then connect into the planet wherever we go to do that, and then make the most important decisions on what do I want to do, what's most important in my life, and what do I want to do at this point in history when we know that everything is changing and everything's going to change only faster in the future as these impacts descend on us.
Thank you, Julian. Another quote in your book that caught our attention was from Ben Kurtman, a leading sea level expert. He told you that South Florida has a message for the rest of the world. Quote, start planning now. How are you going to relocate people? How are you going to change building codes? And this is a state that this is so infuriating. This is a state that until recently, Governor Rick Scott, Now, he was a senator. Now he's the governor, right?
Other way around. He was governor.
Right. Now he's senator. He forbid any state employee from publicly saying or writing in documents the words climate change.
Right. And this is amazing, you know, and in a way, Florida is kind of an extreme example of really what's happening across the country. You know, we have this lunatic administration that's denying it and doing everything the opposite of what we should be doing. And Ben Kirtman, mind you, this is an IPCC author. He is, you know, absolutely, when you look at his credentials, it's so what he says goes and people better listen to it, but they're not. And especially in Florida, where this is a place we already have sea level rise coming up in Miami and Miami Beach, where you can see it on sunny days, even amidst a drought, which is what happened when I was there. And he and his colleague, Dr. Wanless, who I mentioned earlier, talk about if we had a responsible government, we would have an enforced evacuation and relocation happening right now across all of South Florida. That includes decommissioning the Turkey Point nuclear plant that's just south of Miami at 6 feet sea level rise, but instead of that, they're adding another nuclear reactor. It would include mediation, removal of all the toxic sites, relocating libraries, art museums, archives, everything that could be lost, that will be lost with sea levels, moving all of that, including tens of millions of people in their homes. And that has to be happening right now so that it's orderly, or we can wait and put it off and pretend like none of this is going to happen and have pure utter chaos, which is exactly what's happening in Florida.
Wow. Final thoughts, Dar. I mean, what do you think at this point is most effective? Obviously, we need massive policy changes. That is not going to happen with this administration in the White House. So until we have massive change where we can get policy changes at the federal level, there's hope at the state and local levels. What are your thoughts?
I agree. And that's what I stay focused on. And I stay focused on what I can do. Because if I keep looking at the big picture, it's completely overwhelming. And so I try to find out, I ask myself each day, what can I do? What else can I do? What can I do better? And I think all of us have to make these decisions for ourselves. I don't think there's one blanket action for everyone. I think it's such a critical point in history that each one of us now needs to look deep inside and figure out, how am I going to live my life today?
And do you think, Dar, quickly, in the large scheme of things, using less, trying not to use plastic, changing your diet, all of that stuff really does matter?
Absolutely. And I do it too, because we're, again, back to that moral obligation. It's the right thing to do, and we absolutely should do it simply because of that.
Dar Jamel is author of The End of Ice, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption. He will be in Berkeley tonight at 7:30, First Congregational Church. Saturday, 7:30, First Presbyterian Church in San Anselmo, both events in California. March 13th, the Lensic Performing Arts Center at 7 o'clock in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Dar, thank you so much for your work. Thanks for this great book, and thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Rose. Thanks again.
Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will discuss reports of negotiations between U.S. diplomats and members of the Taliban that could lead to U.S. troops withdrawing from Afghanistan. We'll talk about coverage. We will also talk about the more than 1,000 journalists and staff members from several media outlets, including BuzzFeed and The Huffington Post, who were laid off. What does that mean for the media? Thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. And we now have a new logo, thanks to designer Tom DJ. You can check out our logo at yourcallradio.org and check out Tom's great work at bossmangraphics.com. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.